Welcome to Claim Edge, your resource for litigated claims management and resolution. I'm Jim Chapman, your host, and my guest today is Steve Embry. Steve is the founder of Embry Law and teaches about the use of legal technology in litigation and courtroom persuasion. He also writes the Legal Tech Crossroads blog. Steve shared his story of how he started working in claims litigation, writing a blog about legal tech, and some predictions about the future of litigation. I enjoyed the conversation, and I'm sure you will too. Because the Claim Edge podcast is focused on litigated claims, today we'll be talking with Steve about the use of technology in litigation and how it is enabling attorneys and their clients to get better results. Steve, welcome to the Claim Edge podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you a guest on a show. You and I have known each other for a few years through a mutual bar organization that we've been involved in, but I would like to start by asking, you practiced law in a very large law firm, started your own firm a few years ago. What was your pathway to practicing law and ultimately the space that you're in now?
Well, it's kind of interesting. For most of my career practicing law, I was with a fairly large law firm, and we did a lot of mass tort defense work all over the nation, actually, and even outside of the country, which is kind of unusual for a firm in Louisville, Kentucky. But one of my mentors at the firm originated that practice, and I kind of picked up on it. And it got to be kind of funny from time to time, particularly after I got into the FDCC. Other members would call me and say, "What about this judge in Louisville?" And I would have to say, "I don't have a clue about any judges in Louisville because I only appear before judges outside of Louisville." Along the way, I got interested in technology for lawyers and the legal profession and innovation, because legal is notoriously slow to adopt technology. And I always tell the story, I first got interested in technology. I was taking my family to Florida. We were going on a vacation with two small kids at the time. They were in the back, and my wife was driving because I was working on a brief. I put the brief down and was reading, I guess it was the American Lawyer or one of those publications, and there was an article about Fred Bartlett of Bartlett and Beck. And in the article, he was quoted as saying, "Well, I'm a big fan of technology right now. I'm sitting in my condo in Colorado overlooking the mountains working on a brief. And I'm sitting here with papers all through my hands, kids screaming." And I said, "That's for me." And so I got interested in technology and practice management. I kind of reached a point in my career where I thought it was time to do something else and was able to do that, fortunately. About 5 years ago, I left the firm and started a blog to write about legal technology and innovation. Along the way, I became involved in the American Bar Association's Law Practice Division that I now chair. I still continue to practice, although no place near what I once did. I'm now basically in an advisory capacity for large cases and large issues, but I don't do the trench work, depositions and trials. It's heavy lifting, the fun stuff I kind of get to do.
It's funny that you mentioned Fred Bartlett. I can recall that article from some years ago, and I'm sure he was an inspiration to a lot of folks about the idea of using technology in the practice. He and my dad were classmates at the United States Military Academy at West Point. I can recall meeting him at one of my dad's class reunions some years ago, and definitely was a lion of the bar.
And my connection with him is, it's not a personal connection, but just a sort of inspirational connection. When he found the firm, Bartlett Beck, he was instrumental in establishing alternative fee structures. And a few years after that, I was fortunate enough to be national counsel for a carrier in some construction defect-related product litigation all over the country. For about 2 years of that representation, this was in the late 90s, we did it on a flat fee, alternative fee structure. And it really opened my eyes about the different mindset you have when you are operating, you know, on that basis. One of the first things I did, for example, was look at our local counsel relationships. And I discovered that since they were coming out of my pocket, that we were paying way too much and getting far too little. So I had a pretty aggressive program to find the right kind of local counsel. We began using people that were part-time, that, you know, were much lower rates, much lower overhead. When you start looking for savings as a practicing lawyer, you can find them, particularly when they're coming out of your pocket. And it was just a lot of fun. But after that, I always pitched alternative fees, although most of the time I would get the reaction from clients that, "Boy, that's really interesting. but I think we'll stick with the billable hour.
Yeah, you know, it's funny that large organizations, insurance carriers, corporate clients, they're just so used to being billed by the hour, and they've built this kind of massive infrastructure around the billable hour, e-billing, for example. Even if they thought it was a credible alternative, it's so hard to move away from that.
I was fortunate at the time to have a very innovative general counsel with the insurance carrier. He saw the benefit of it. And it's funny, at one point he said, well, so what happens if we pay you a flat fee, but you get all the work done in a fraction of the time? And I said, well, okay, we'll put a collar on it. If I only work X number of hours, I don't get the whole flat fee. I only get a portion of it. He said, that's great. And I said, but what about the other end? If I have to work way too much, I want the same kind of protection on the other side, which he said, that's fair. And we did that, which at the time was pretty innovative, I thought. It gave us both a little bit of protection in case things went way different than what we thought they would. And they did not. I mean, we didn't get into the collar on either side, either of the years. But that was sort of the deal.
I know that you publish a blog, Tech Law Crossroads. What led to that?
I was getting more interested in technology in the legal space, and I began writing things for LinkedIn and publishing things there. And one of my good friends, Kevin O'Keefe, who is LexBlog, a blogging platform for lawyers, said, you ought to just have your own blog. So I started writing a blog, and I would get up in the morning, and if I was going to be working on the blog, I'd wake up in a good mood and all excited and run out and start doing it. If I had to get up and go do legal work, I was like, So after a few months of that, I thought, you know, maybe this blog thing is where I need to be right. And I've had a lot of fun doing it. I try to post something at least once a week, some weeks more, some weeks less, depending on what's going on. I'm also on a legal journalist roundtable every Friday with some folks, Bob Ambrosio from Law Sites and some people from Above the Law and Law.com. There's five or six of us, and we each pick a story of the week. So I've enjoyed doing that. I've done that for about a year and a half, 2 years. And I speak, and of course, anytime you take a leadership role with the ABA in any sort of position, it takes some time. So I've enjoyed doing that. I could not have designed a better exit ramp from the full-time practice of law had I tried. It's just been marvelous.
Well, I certainly enjoy your occasional posts. They're always interesting and entertaining. There's been a lot of buzz today about data analytics, artificial intelligence, really throughout society. It's kind of permeating everything. You've got a front row seat, you know, chairing the law practice division for the ABA, your blog, and the other things you do journalistically. How do you see that affecting litigation, Steve?
It's pretty fundamental because, you know, the tools that we have now, particularly for federal court litigation, but more and more for state court litigation, have taken us out of the realm of my gut instinct is to, here's the data that confirms it. You can know how many cases a lawyer has tried if you're hiring them. And that was always an issue with me with local counsel. As you probably know, everybody that you want to hire for litigation will say, I'm a trial lawyer. And for years, we had no way of really knowing, no efficient way of really knowing. Now we do. I mean, I can find out how many cases, you can find out how many cases I've tried in federal court. You can find out how many cases the lawyer on the other side has tried, and what judge. We can figure out the judge's proclivity for timelines, which is a phenomenal piece of information to manage client expectations. If you're my client in a case, I can say, well, Jim, you know, this judge typically will not decide motions to dismiss or summary judgment motions until at least 6 months in the case. Then you can budget that, and you know what is coming up, as opposed to calling me up every week or so and saying, when's that judge going to decide our motion? And I'm like, well, I think the judge will probably get to it. Oh, that's a couple months. So it's a good tool. And you can use those tools for settlement purposes. If you know a judge is coming up on a decision point, typically maybe now's the time to have some settlement discussions. Getting more and more into the realm of being able to be more predictive about what judges will decide in a given motion, how often they grant summary judgment motions, or how often they grant motions to dismiss. All of these things are are now available. And the beauty of it is we're getting more and more ability to peer into the state court analytics. Bob Ambrosia and I have a running debate. I always tell Bob, I said, you were the first person to say that not using data analytics may soon become malpractice. And he said, no, I didn't say that. You said that first. but it's getting to be true. And I think, you know, lawyers and legal professionals that don't tune into that wealth of information, I think will risk getting further and further behind. When I was practicing law, we didn't have access to that information. And it was a lot of times sort of just a wild ass guess. And pardon the language, but now it's not a guess anymore. It's more science. We're seeing a lot more artificial intelligence programs now that are available, which scares a lot of practitioners to death when it shouldn't, because it's a tool that we will have that we didn't have before.
Think about artificial intelligence, and a lot of people, their eyes glaze over. What do you really mean by that? Probably the one that is most on the national consciousness today is GPT or ChatGPT. Right. Which came out late last year, that appears to be able to write things, to generate text right. about any topic under the sun. I've been playing around with a little bit myself in terms of what its capacities are. Sometimes it's very good and sometimes it's outlandish.
It's an interesting subject. Richard Susskind, one of the biggest names in the legal tech field, listened to a talk by him recently about it. And a couple of points. One, it's important for lawyers to understand what these machines are doing and how they're doing it differently than what we do as lawyers. I mean, they're not thinking, they're crunching data. And we now have the computing power for them to crunch a lot of data. And we have a lot of data at our fingertips now for them, for the machines to access. And the machines now have the ability to learn, if you will. And I use that term in quotes, learn. And they're not learning like we learn, but they are understanding patterns and being able to recognize patterns on a go forward basis. So they can do a lot more. But the interesting thing that Richard pointed out, he said, you know, clients are really interested in outcomes. That's what they really want. And machines can't create, can't make, can't promulgate an outcome. Only people can promulgate outcomes. What machines can do, what artificial intelligence can do, is reduce the uncertainty around various outcomes, so that you can start to begin assessing probabilities of various outcomes and which one makes the most sense. But only a person can get you to the outcome in most cases. And so, you know, it's important, I think, for lawyers and legal professionals to recognize both of those points, how machines come up with what they do and what they're really doing. And there's a lot of things that artificial intelligence can now do that will make our lives easier. ChatGPT, for example. We all have written fact statements and statements of law and briefs that we've used 35 times. You know, the standard for summary judgment is blah, blah, blah. I don't even know if judges want to read that stuff anymore, but we always put it in, right? We had access to a program that would just plop that in so we could just quickly read it and make any quick changes, as opposed to scrambling around trying to find the language and some other brief and cutting and pasting it and screwing it up and all that jazz. We'd be so much better off. And that's just a small example of a good use of ChatGPT. I've looked at it too, and it was an interesting program that came out, or article that program came out here recently, about whether ChatGPT could pass a bar exam. So it probably can, right? Because a lot of the nature of the questions require less analytical skills and more recollecting skills, which is exactly what artificial intelligence is really good at. So
I'm sure it would be a hands-down winner on Jeopardy.
Probably so.
You've been actively involved in the technology programs that the FDCC's got in place. Evolve, FedTech University or FedTech U, that sort of thing. And that clearly that's a passion of yours, is the use of technology in the courtroom, right? Certainly lawyers, litigators are always looking for some kind of edge. What are the technologies that you see there that are helping now, and maybe even a little prediction around the future?
It's so changeable that it's kind of hard to say, well, let's use this or let's use that. A lot of visualization technologies that lawyers can use in the courtroom to get people closer to actually being at a place or time. we can't immerse somebody, you know, back to the scene of the accident that happened 2 years ago. But with a lot of the tools that are available, we can pretty accurately and pretty close get them to that spot, which is of immeasurable importance most of the time. Right now, I think the important thing that lawyers need to realize, of course, the FDCC is made up of primarily of litigators, and that's our focus. But really, when you think about it, almost every lawyer's key job is to communicate and to persuade, whether that's a client, whether it's a tax person at the IRS, or whoever it is. That's basically what we do, communicate and persuade. And most people in the non-legal realm, and even in the legal realm, they receive and are educated today with technological tools. I mean, you and I are talking through computers, and we're not in the same room, but we are having a discussion, and that's how people learn. And so our big thing with FedTechU is if you want to persuade today's generation, and I'm used generation in a big sense, you have to, in essence, meet those people where they are. And where they are is the use of technology. So if you don't use technology to help persuade, then you're going to be at a disadvantage to those people who are. And that's why we started FedTechU, because we wanted to be sure that our members had the opportunity to have access to the latest and greatest tools, whether that's PowerPoint, whether that's TrialPad, whatever it is. Evolve is a good name for the program because it is constantly evolving every year. And it's a fascinating program. We have about 25 people. It's a 2.5-day intensive workshop, and they all come. We have several faculty members. I'm one of the faculty members. We help show them how to use some of the tools that are there, and then we turn them loose, and they stand up the second day and give either an opening statement or closing statement or mediation statement to the group using some of these tools. You know, I got to tell you, I'm always proud of the FDCC and its members, because I sit in there and listen to these statements thinking, and I'm just wowed, A, by how good the statements are, but B, how quickly they are able to grasp technology and use technology tools to tell the story that they want to tell.
It is a great organization. And you make an interesting point about the use of technology today and kind of meeting people where they are. Do you see clients, insurance companies, corporate clients, having expectations around the use of technology or setting expectations around the use of technology?
You know, it depends. There are FDCC members, corporate members, who I have heard say, if you don't demonstrate to me some proficiencies in technology, I just won't hire you. I'm sorry. There are others that care a little less, although there are a couple of drivers now that go beyond just persuasion abilities. One is cybersecurity. Many, many clients are now putting some guideposts out there that have to be met. You know, if I'm going to handle your data, your sensitive documents, then you're going to make sure that I'm adequately protecting those. So that's forcing greater interest both on the client side and on the lawyer side. The other piece of that is time savings. You know, since most of us still bill by the hour, at least on the defense side of the ledger, as the economy tightens, I think we're going to see more pressure from in-house counsel, insurance companies, for us to do more with less. That will presumably force us to begin using more technology and a whole lot around us. And historically, that's been the fact. I mean, if you look back to the last recession, the Great Recession we had, and some of the technologies that spawned out of that, smartphones, greater use of the internet, cloud computing, you see a lot of those kinds of innovations that occurred then, and I suspect we'll see a lot coming out of what I think is a recession looming, although, you know, one of my friends says this recession is a rhino, recession in name only. but we shall see. I hope he's right.
So true. Lex Machina reported recently that litigation, and I think this was just focused on federal court litigation, it's grown almost 50% in the last 5 years. And I'm sure with your national practice in class actions and that sort of thing, you probably have a front row seat to that. Any thoughts about what the future holds for U.S. litigation? Is that going to continue?
I think it is, but it's going to shift from the more traditional things that we thought of in terms of litigation to other things. And I'll give you some examples. The role of technology in workplace safety, for example, is exponentially growing. There are more and more analytical tools designed to ferret out conditions that make accidents more likely. There are more and more assistive devices for workers. There are more and more training tools and using metaverse and immersive technology that will reduce the number of accidents in the workplace. There are more and more robotic tools that can reduce possibility of some catastrophic failures. For example, there's little robotic submarines that can go through water pipes and look for potential leaks. So a lot of that kind of litigation may be prevented. On the other hand, there are different and new issues that can come up. As we were chatting before we went live, I was at the Consumer Electronics Show last week, and it's all billions and potentially new products. For example, there's a developer that is developing a pill that you can swallow, and this pill has got Bluetooth capability, and it can swim around in your stomach, and the doctor can maneuver it and, you know, look for abnormalities, which means endoscopes won't be necessary anymore. You know, we all know about colonoscopies and how being able to take a pill and have that procedure done without the unpleasant preparation would be phenomenal. And that's all well and good, except, you know, that's a new technology that, like any technology, is going to have problems and create litigation. Another developer at CES has an artificial intelligence tool that can ferret out algorithmic bias in various programs. You know, I chatted with the guy for a long time, and I said, I don't know about the future of your program, but I think you're going to have a great future as an expert witness. But so we're going to see different types of litigation as new technologies. You know, and I always use the example of Uber, whether Uber drivers are employees or independent contractors. That question is not easily fit within our framework. Federal judge in San Francisco that was handling the cases, he said, I wish there was like a third category we could put these people in, you know? So we're going to see a lot of sort of new and innovative issues and questions that come up from a legal standpoint as our technology just explodes. I mean, it doesn't grow by onesies and twosies. It grows exponentially, which means what is new today is old tomorrow. So, it's going to be a very, very interesting time in litigation, I think, for a whole lot of people.
Yeah, I think it is likely to continue to grow. It's funny, the insurance industry, they're all about trying to find new risks to underwrite. Right?
Until they found them.
And then they had to figure out how to pay the claims on them. But I do think that you're spot on. Litigation certainly isn't going away, but there are likely to be new causes of action.
Yeah, and it's, the other interesting piece of that is how lawyers, particularly litigators, relate and understand technology. There is this sort of mini debate about whether lawyers need to know how to code, unquote, which, I mean, I don't know how to repair my car, but I do know all the features and benefits, and I have a general working knowledge of how it works. And I think litigators can't ignore technology. You can't adequately conduct discovery these days without having some understanding of technology and the technology being used by your adversaries, because you have to know what questions to ask. And you don't know what questions to ask unless you have some working understanding. So I think in addition to the new and different litigation issues that are going to arise, there's going to be more and more of a need for lawyers to have a better understanding of what technology is, how it works conceptually, and how that can be used to their benefit.
So the future is bright for the practice of law.
Or
I would say
for some, yes. Yeah. For those that are willing to push the envelope and try to do things in the future and use technology, I think it is bright. I think for those that want to practice law like they did 10 years ago, 5 years ago, those days are gone. You know, as the pandemic has changed our entire conception of remote work, what we had before is gone and it's not coming back. And we have to realize that and move forward.
Steve, I've really enjoyed our conversation today and the insights that you've been able to share with us. If any of our listeners want to connect with you, what's the best way for them to do that?
They can do it via email. My email address is sempre@techlawcrossroads.com. My website is techlawcrossroads. And I'm on LinkedIn and Twitter and always happy to connect with people there, even if I don't know you really well, if we have similar interests. So if you want to reach out, feel free to do so.
Well, I'm sure they will. And thanks again for being a guest on our podcast today.
Thank you for having me. I've really enjoyed it.
It was a real pleasure to have Steve Embry, founder of Embry Law, as a guest on the Claim Edge podcast. I hope you enjoyed our conversation about the use of technology in the pursuit of better claim litigation outcomes. As Steve said, if you want to connect with him, you can do that on LinkedIn or email him at sembry@techlawcrossroads.com. Thanks for listening. If you like this episode of Claim Edge, please subscribe on your favorite podcast channel and share it with your colleagues and friends. Until next time, this is Jim Chapman on the Claim Edge podcast, signing off.